accession number 19049, Realf 9.
Malcolm Connolly, Real 9.
Yeah, it was reported that whether it was true or not, I don't know, but he certainly gave the impression that his choice of men would be North Countrymen. Because as far as I know, he stated that North Countrymen are the finest shock troops there is in the world. That give them a rifle and a bayonet and say, up jocks and up them, they would do that. Whereas South Countrymen are more staid. If you want people to sit and take punishment, then you pick a South Countryman. But for the what he had in mind, which was going to be virtually a hand-to-hand, man-to-man warfare in the jungle, he picked regiments like the LFs and Kings, Liverpools, and things like that. There were South Country regiments, though, I quite agree. But I think that's what his personal opinion was. And what he did, a lot of people would argue the task and say he accomplished nothing. But in my opinion, the thing that he accomplished was that he proved to the average town dweller from the United Kingdom that he could and would and did beat the Japanese in and all their fearsome appearances and so forth and so on would beat nothing. And of course, that was the main, in my opinion, that was the main thing that Wingate proved. It was the first time that the British Army had combated the Japanese face to face and come out to tell the tale. And then, of course, the second was in the Arakan with 7th Indian and 5 Indian. They combated the Japanese. They licked his ass, and that altered the opinions that the average... Nobody wanted to go to Burma. Even after the European war had finished, BLA, Burma looms ahead, and nobody wanted to come. Mainly because of the reputation the Japanese had, and also that we were the forgotten army. They forgot about us completely. Even now, some of the things that the books and that are written, they upkeep D-Day, vast amounts of publicity and so forth and so on. But they wouldn't, they don't give a lot of credence to the 14th Army, none at all. And yet, we prove beyond any shadow of doubt that the Burma campaign was the longest campaign of the Second World War. We had the longest front in the Second World War. It was a multinational army of not only Brits, we had Indians, Pakis. They weren't Pakis in those days, of course, but they were Pakistanis. There was East Africans, West Africans, Chinese, you name them, and they were there. And we were organized, we were fed, and we were watered, and we made one of the longest advances, and we inflicted upon the Japanese the greatest defeat they've ever suffered in their history. We suffered on the retreat out. It was the longest retreat ever suffered by the British Army, even beats the retreat of the big chap in Spain during the Anglo-Spanish War or something. Our chaps had to retreat from the Satong River all the way back to Infal. There was no one there to greet them. There was no cups of teas and bars of chocolate, no women to shake them by the hand. Only certain Indian generals, British Indian generals, who criticized them because they got beaten. And the British Indian Army, the 14th Army, was possibly, will go down the annuals as one of the greatest armies that, certainly Slim was one of the, was the finest general of the Second World War. Because he had nothing. He had nothing to fight with. He cut down the jungle and made boats. in fact, the Americans, they took a lot of the landing craft away to put them in Europe. If Europe was short of stuff, they took our stuff and sent it to Europe. The landing craft that we crossed the Irrawaddy, there wasn't sufficient. There wasn't sufficient for them to go across as they should have done. And this is one thing that really annoys me, is the fact that I didn't ask to be sent to India and Burma. I'd have been quite content to go to the desert or to Italy. I don't know what could have been like there. I never found out. It probably wasn't very pleasant. But to be quite truthful, I didn't want to go to India and Burma to fight the Japanese. And to be quite truthful, I suppose when my regiment was disbanded and we were sent there, well, you just have to take it as it comes. And of course, we were better. Our line of communication during the Imphal siege, we was down to a quarter rations. A lot of the artillery guns, most of the artillery guns were rationed to 6 rounds per day per gun. Us, in the tank forces, we were allowed, because we were used mainly as mobile artillery, we were allowed to fire as much ammunition as we wanted. But altogether, when I came out of Imphal, I was just over 6 stone. I was a normal man of 10 stone 8 to 11 stone. What people like the infantry chaps must have been like, it was hard to say. But we were hungry, and that was the difference. We were hungry, but the Japanese starved. And even though they were starving, I mean, when you see films at Belsen and places like that, the Japanese soldier was like that. And he was still willingly fight you. And it's a great shame after all these years that such men had to be so brutal to earn themselves a reputation that by a lot of people is neither forgiven or forgotten.
You said to me earlier that you met Louis Allen on an occasion when he said to you that this was a rankers' war, not an officers' war.
That was his words to me. He said, I always believed, he said, until I read about the Carbineers, that officers won wars. He said, but I have changed my opinion. He said, after reading about Nunchigum, and he did mention Nunchigum, he said, that has made me disprove and disbelieve that this is so. Because, let's face it, a sergeant major, troopers, killed over 250 Japanese, took back one of the greatest assailants in that part of the world. And on many occasions, my own experience, my troop officer was killed, my troop sergeant was knocked out. Who was there to take command? Only a trooper.
So you agree with him?
In certain incidents, I think that the officer class, and there is a great deal of class distinction, both in the Indian and the British Army. My own regiment, the 3rd Senior Regiment of Cavalry, their officers were, I won't say they were chosen, but they were a class apart from us. They really were never one of us. I can never remember any officer coming to me as a person and chatting about something. They never told us nothing. Perhaps they didn't know themselves. But mostly they were young officers, not much more older than me. My troop officer, David Mean Austin, he was 20, 21. I was 21. He had a bright future. But the point is that whether he knew and didn't tell us, I don't know. But certainly they never told us what was happening. We used to get more information from All India Radio than we did from our own Carbineers Oh, we knew that tomorrow morning at Rivali we'd have breakfast and we would go up the road to milestone such and such, hoping we might bump into some enemy opposition. That's all. They never told us if we were successful. The only thing that was explained to us, that in the battle for Mudbum, that someone, somewhere, who, I don't know, according to our troop leaders, a VC was spoke about. But our squadron leader, and I agree with his point of view, he said if it was a VC, it could only possibly go to one person, and that was the tank commander, Lieutenant John Coles. He said he didn't agree. He said if it couldn't be given to the crew in some form or other, then no one should have it. And I fully agree with that. And so the Carbineers never got, if that was right, but that was the rumour.
What kind of information did you get from All India Radio?
Mostly music. That's what we wanted. We used to get the news that the Japanese had surrounded Imphal. British forces were retreating here, and British forces were there. And of course, there was a great deal of internal trouble in India anyway, civil disobedience and so forth and so on. But mainly, we used to try and get our operator, and it was very difficult, wireless or radio country, because of the height of the mountains. And some days you could get it quite plainly, other days you couldn't get it at all. And altogether, it was quite nice to put your headphones on and listen to All India Music, All India Radio from Delhi, playing music, which we got nothing of at all.
What music did you want?
The same as they got over here. What any young man wants, the music of the day. Vera Lynn is singing to us, and all those, what's his name, the big American band leader, can't think of his name now, his type of music. Vera Lynn did come, but she didn't come up to us. The other thing I must mention is that while we was besieged in Lion Box, Kangatombi, it was raining like the hammers, and Noel Coward came sitting in the back of a 3-ton army lorry. He had a piano, and he drove right up, and he pulled the things back in the pouring rain, and he sang to us. And when he came home, he got himself into trouble. He complained about the conditions of 14th Army. But I always remember him. Why the Japanese didn't shoot him, I don't know. Because they must have been in range of him. And after that, we got one or two film shows, a mobile film show. And one I remember I saw in Oysterbox was Greer Garson in about the air raids on the United Kingdom. Greer Garson.
Mrs. Miniver.
Mrs. Miniver, yes, yes, that's right. I remember seeing that, and they showed us two films of Greer Garson. Can't remember what the other one was, but that was the only two films we ever saw. Some of the units had mobile showers. The Carbineers, we didn't. We washed and bathed in rivers and buckets for 2 years. There was never any. When we got down as far as Prome, they actually cut 50-gallon petrol barrels in two. And they put another 50-gallon barrel with bricks and lit a fire underneath and put a tap on it. So they boiled 50 gallons of hot water, and each member could go and get a certain measure of hot water, put it in these so-called baths, which was half a barrel. You had to get your own cold water from somewhere, and you could have a bath. And that was the first bath, real hot bath, we'd had since we left India.
Did you ever come across this Quit India movement yourself, this political
movement?
Oh,
yes, yes, yes. When I was 26 as Tsar, we weren't allowed out of camp unless you were armed, which meant to say you went and drew a 3.8 pistol with 6 rounds of ammunition. Any lorry leaving camp had to be escorted. And on this particular day, I was detailed to be escort to a 1,500 weight lorry to go to Nara Station to pick up a parcel or whatever it was. I don't know what was in it. But we had to go there to pick up this parcel from the railway station. So, Hobson, I was only the escort. I wasn't the driver. Anyway, we pulled up outside Nara Station. And the driver went in to get this package because he had to sign for it. And my duty was to stay with the lorry to safeguard it. Anyway, I looked up and the driver came out of the station and went like that. He yelled me, come and give me a hand. He says, it's too heavy for me. So I went across, helped him load this parcel up, which is quite a big parcel, and brought it back to the lorry. We struggled and loaded it in the lorry. The driver got in to try and start it up, and it wouldn't start. So we lift the bonnet up, and it wasn't long before we realized the reason it wouldn't start, somebody nicked the rotor arm. Which in actual fact, we were told that if we ever left it, we had to do that. I hadn't done that, because I shouldn't have left the lorry. Anyway, what do we do? Two young fellas, without leadership. So I said to the driver, I said, well, the only thing to do is you'll have to make your way back to Nara, to the camp. I said, and see if you can get assistance. I said, I'm the only one that's armed, so I said, stay here and protect this vehicle. So off we started to walk. And when I looked up, I sat in the passenger side of the 1500 weight, which was a 1500 weight Ford. And when I looked up, the driver had gone, and there was groups of all these young Indians and people all massing on the other side of the road. And they didn't look very friendly. And I thought to myself, well, what do I do? I've got a pistol, a 3.8 pistol, with 6 rounds. There must be at least 100 to 200 of them. What do I do? So I thought, discretion was the best partner of valor. So I got in the lorry. I sat in the lorry and said nothing. I just bowed my head, and that was that. And I must have sat there with all these people. They didn't come anywhere near the lorry, but they were definitely belligerent. And they were chanting different things. They used to wear different colours, yellow and green, I think, which was the colours of the Indian Congress. I'm not quite sure about that, but I think that's what I'm right in saying that. Anyway, I sat there for about a half an hour, and then suddenly another Hussar lorry come tearing round the corner with my driver in it, and he got picked up and got back to camp, got another rotor arm, and we started up and he drove it back. And I thought, oh, we're going to get punished for this. Because the army in those days, discipline was quite severe in many cases. Anyway, we were very quickly told the commanding officer wanted to see us. So we marched up in front of the commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Norman Norton. And he congratulated us. He said what we did was correct. That no one could help what had happened. But it was one of those situations that wasn't very pleasant. And also when I was in Bombay on the Duck Ferrian party, there was lots and lots of trouble in Bombay. The buses went on strike and there was rioting in the streets. And to be quite truthful, there was a battalion there called the East Yorkshires. What battalion, I don't remember. But they asked for armoured support because the rioting was getting out of hand. So there was no armoured units in the Bombay area, and there was only 12 or 14 of us up in Calaba barracks. So we were warned to take an armoured car, two armoured cars with crews. We had only had one officer, so one sergeant, so troopers in this particular case commanded the two armoured cars. And we went down to where all this yelling and shouting and setting fire, turning, quite horrendous, really. And all we had was a line of these young East Yorkshires across the road, wearing no protection except a baton bowler and rifle and bayonet, in shorts, as we did dressed in India with shorts and KD. And we had to pull up behind them, and all these hordes of Indians come tearing down the road. Though we couldn't understand what they were yelling about, we got the impression we weren't too popular. And they threw bottles and stones and things like that, and these young fellows across the road were being felled by a stone in the face or things like that. And if they were felled, they were just picked up, stuck in an ambulance, and somebody else took their place. And this went on all half an hour to an hour, all this confrontation. And the Yorkshires weren't allowed to dismiss, and the Indian crowds weren't going to go. And then all of a sudden, there was a man there, an Indian magistrate, and they brought out a placard in which it was written three times, once in English, once in Hindi, and once in Urdu, that they would be ordered to disperse. And this was shouted out three times. And if they failed to disperse on the third command, they would be fired upon. They didn't disperse. And the next thing we knew was that the Indian magistrate, in full view of all this crowd that's chanting, gets a document which gives... It was the Indian who was signing the fire order, not the Brits. The Indian magistrate was the one who signed the order that we should open fire. But not us, because we didn't have anything there. We had an armoured car with no weapons in it, no ammunition in it anyway. And we carried 3.8 pistols, but we had no ammunition at all. It was just for show. Anyway, it was shouted out, and the next thing we knew was the order. They didn't obey. Up come the East Yorkshires, and before they had a chance to fire, the crowd had gone. And that was the end of it. But it was quite horrendous. And I was there when Gandhi spoke to the crowds in the streets of Bombay. And he spoke in English, which was translated into Hindi and Urdu. But he initially spoke in English over a loudspeaker. And because his life was in a certain amount of danger, they had British soldiers in various points, vulnerable points, to safeguard him. We had, if we saw any undue movements, we could open fire without an order and kill whoever was doing it. But I remember basically what he said. And he said that he had no argument with the British. He liked the British. He had many British friends. But he said, "This is my land." He said, "And we don't want the British here." And he said, "They tell us that if we don't obey sort of a thing, that the Japanese will have us." He said, "We're not frightened of the Japanese." He said, "Why should we be frightened of the Japanese?" He said, "They're a nation of somewhere about 60 to 80,000 millions. And he said, "We've got 800 millions. He said, "Let them come. We will outbreed them." He said, "But the English," he said, "I like them." He said, "But this is my land," he said, "and I want them to go home and to leave us alone." And he also appealed that he didn't agree with violence. He didn't like violence at all. And he appealed to the crowd to go home and not to use violence against the British. And a few days after that, civil disobedience ceased and they obeyed Gandhi. But he was a wizened little man. I remember him quite well because there were so few of us doing this job on the docks. And I suppose that with the Bombay virtually was just a place of transit. People were coming in to India. They were being organized, put up to different places with India, but there was hardly any troops in India. It was basically a holiday camp. Bombay wasn't bad. I quite like Bombay. We could go swimming. There was plenty of restaurants. If you had any money, that was the big problem, was money. Didn't have much. But we could go and get a meal in the different restaurants, the Chinese, the Indians, there were millions of them. And they were open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you ever wanted to eat, you could always... In fact, you could sit in the Metro Cinema in Bombay, which was air-conditioned, a beautiful place. And all you had to do was hold your hand up like that. And an Indian would come and say, "Yes, sir, what would you like?" And if you wanted a bottle of beer or a bottle of pop or something like that, he would go and fetch it. And it was quite a good station, to be quite true. I didn't want to leave it. I was quite happy there.
And which month was Gandhi giving the speech?
Oh, dear, dear, now you're asking me something. I got there in the December of 1942, and I was returned back to my unit somewhere about August of 1942.
No, not 1942.
No? 43, I beg your pardon. Yeah. I arrived in India in June 1942. Yeah, June 1942. And I was posted to Bombay in the December of 1942.
I think you were posted to Bombay in June 42, were you not?
June 42?
So you told me earlier.
No, I think that's wrong, because we didn't... The RWGHK didn't arrive in India until June of 1942. We'd been on the... We left the United Kingdom in the February...
That's when you arrived in Bombay on the ship.
On the ship, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. I was posted to the 26th Hussar, and in December of 1942, I was posted to the Bombay Ferrying Party. And I was returned back to the 26th Hussar somewhere about July, August, because we was on our way to Burma in September.
I think it's probably impossible to say which month it was at this stage.
It is, yes.
It's probably on the record, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you agree with what Gandhi said at the time?
Well, no, I don't think I did. To be quite truthful, we'd been trained in the short period of time that I'd been in India. We was taught by our superiors that India was under our domination. We were the masters. They were the servants. And we were ordered that Indians would not call us Johnny. They would have to call us Sub. And we were taught not to be friendly to the Indian. The Indian, if we passed him on the pavement, he got off the pavement for us. And that was the way we were taught. But when I left India, it was the other way about. The Indian didn't get off the pavement for me. I got off the pavement for him. No, I mean, as young men, I mean, let's face it, you go to these places. And let's face it, I'd heard my father talk about India. I must admit, I was only five or so when I came home. But I remember my mother talking about the Ayer and the Dobie Waller and all the rest of it. And... I went to that land, and to be quite truthful, it was exactly as I remembered that my parents